You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Me. What has happened to the locks? I tried to get in, my key's not working.
Oh, I changed them. And you've been gone so long. I thought you'd left them. I thought you'd bequeathed this apartment to me.
I hope you've been paying the mortgage as well then.
And what you bought me anyway? You bought me a present.
Orval, the greatest beer known to man.
Oh, really? I've been fueling mostly. Well, we've already advertised Vichy Catalan, the greatest mineral water on the planet, on this podcast, but that's what I've been mainly fueling up on.
I see you've been maintaining the coffee machine, that's what I want.
Yes.
Have you put the washer on as well and cleaned up?
Rob, a few weeks ago we did an intro to the podcast. That was me arriving in Mallorca. That was before I took over your property. Much in the same fashion, we came out to the balcony, didn't we? And we admired the view. You told us what we were contemplating, the beautiful Serra de Tramuntana that we can see. As you can see, the weather in your absence has been pretty fine, and it is today.
It's a bit finer than where I've been. I've been traipsing around Bruges, surrounded by... I felt at home, actually. I think I have more Spanish tourists in Bruges than I've ever seen anywhere else. My partner, who's from here as well, she was so embarrassed she started speaking English halfway through because she didn't want to blend in with the rest of the tourists. But it seems like here things are pretty much unchanged. They've picked a few lemons and oranges from those trees, haven't they?
Yeah. Lemon orange harvest coming up, isn't it? Rob, you're off again. You're off again
a few
couple
days,
of days.
Yeah, straight after Roubaix, going to Brabant-Appel and Amstel. And I'm hoping this time I'm not going to need to get any more keys cut or anything like that.
Well, in the meantime, since I've got you for 3 or 4 hours before I cart you off again to the airport, how do you feel about recording a podcast?
Sounds good,
I think Mitch Docker is waiting for us. Mitch Docker. If Paris-Roubaix is your Christmas, then I guess today is something like Boxing Day. Well, it's Tuesday. It's not the day after Paris-Roubaix, but are you on a bit of a downer? Is it after the big day?
Yeah, it's not quite as exciting with Amstel around the corner, is it? You sort of forget about that. You're like, oh, that's right. There's another race coming. Oh, Liège is coming, and you shouldn't be like that, but yeah, it's a bit like that. You know, the new year rolls on. New year's coming up. I guess Liège is like the new year. You sort of get excited about it. You're probably going to have a few drinks, but you're not going to get quite as roly poly as Christmas Day, are you?
It's roly poly. What does getting roly poly entail?
Well, roly poly means like you eat and drink too much, whereas New Year's Eve, you just probably drink too much.
Yeah. Anyway, Mitch, you are not with us. You are not with us in Mallorca. How the devil are you otherwise?
I'm doing well. I'm recovering from a big night watching Roubaix and drinking a little bit too much. It was a good night. Like, it was really fun. Off the back of our conversation last week, I think it was actually off air, we were talking about it, or maybe it was on air, I can't remember now. Running. I've just started the Lancewood Run Club, and I just got back just in time. We had a good turnout tonight, 15 runners. So, headlamps on, it's winter here.
Mitch, last week, so as you know, I think running is my sport, my sort of leisure activity these days. I made the mistake last week of going for a bike ride with the gentleman on my left, Rob Hatch, and it was a pretty leisurely bike ride up the Col de Soya, so Rob's local climb.
Yeah.
But I felt a bit nailed the next day. I mean, you know, kept my heart rate nice and low, zone 2 pretty much all the way up. But the next day when I tried to do an epic run, I didn't feel too good.
Mitch, he's lying.
He attacked me
and then he went straight up the climb. He took about 3 minutes off me, which isn't hard in my current sort of state of form. But he wasn't exactly in zone 2 and his heart rate was up.
Well, I'll publish the data and everyone can make their own minds up. Chaps, we should do a news roundup, not featuring our ride up the Col de Soya last week. We'll kick off where we jumped off last Tuesday. It was the eve of Skelder Price. Rob, you commentated on Skelder Price, I think.
Yep, I was there in Scotland. They were all what was the roly poly? They were all roly poly by the afternoon in Scotland. They always are, aren't they?
Yeah, everyone generally is. We were laughing last week, Mitch. We were laughing at L'Equipe calling Soudal Quick Step a pack of chihuahuas more than a wolf pack. Well, who is guffawing under their moustache now? Mitch Docker, because Tim Merlier of Sudal Quickstep went on to snaffle top prize, like the big ferocious apex predator that he and his teammates are, or were, until the weekend when they sort of reverted to chihuahua mode. More on that later, maybe. Speaking of the weekend, hopefully most of you will have tuned into our Arrivé episode on Sunday night. That was with our bones still vicariously jangling, our ears still ringing, having heard Mathieu van der Poel's rapturous reception in the Roubaix Velodrome. MVDP, the winner of his second Roubaix title, his sixth monument. He was joined on the podium by his teammate Jasper Philipsen and Mads Pedersen. The previous day, in similar fashion, as in clothes, as in the rainbow jersey, but not the manner of victory, Lotta Kopecky of SD Works Pro Time outsprinted Elisa Balsamo of Lidl Trek and Pfeiffer Georgie of DSM Firmenich Post NL to take the women's race. Remaining in France, we'll also just update you on a stage race that took place in the northwest of the country last week, the Région Pays de la Loire Tour, formerly known as the Circuit de la Sarthe. Four stages there, two of them won by EF Education First, Marijn van den Berg, one by Alberto Dainese of Tudor, one by Ewen Costu of Arkea, and van den Berg also won the GC. Meanwhile, in Spain, of course, the main stage race event of the week was supposed to be the Itzulia Tour of the Basque Country. I'll just give you the stage winners and final result before adding the big, very regrettable footnote. So, stage winners, Roglic, Lapeja, Hermans, Menkes, Grégoire and Rodriguez. And the GC went, thanks to barnstorming Spanish alliance with Rodriguez on the final stage, to Eibar, to UAE Team Emirates' Juan Ayuso. That, though, of course, wasn't the full story. Stage 4 had been marred by a huge crash involving Remco Evenepoel, Primoz Roglic, and defending champion Jonas Vingegaard. Among others, Roglic had already crashed the previous day, but he was the only one on this occasion to escape without any broken bones. Evenepoel suffered a break to his right scapula and collarbone, the latter requiring surgery, which was later carried out successfully in Belgium. Vingegaard's main injuries were a collapsed lung as well as a broken collarbone and several broken ribs. AS, a Spanish newspaper, reported on Monday, Rob, I think you read this as well, that Vingegaard was operated on yesterday, so on Monday. Apparently, that was surgery to repair the collapsed lung.
Yeah, we think that. They weren't exactly 100% clear on exactly the surgery, but I think because that was the late diagnosis, that they were guessing that.
He'll remain in hospital for a few more days. He's in Vitoria-Gasteiz, isn't he?
He is, and he's in intensive care at the minute, which the report added is normal procedure after such surgery.
Another rider to suffer very significant injuries was UAE Team Emirates' Jay Vine. Jay Vine, I think there should be a corrections corner from about 5 or 6 weeks ago on Jay Vine. I think I said on the podcast he was from Perth. He's not, is he, Mitch? He's from your neck of the woods.
No, he's not from Victoria. He's from Townsville, right up north in Queensland. Not a whole heap of cyclists coming from up that way.
Well, it was a tough week for Jay Vine as well, and a tough day to the Basque Country. In that crash, he suffered significant injuries. They were cervical and two thoracic spine vertebral fractures. He won't need surgery, but he may have to wear a neck brace for up to 6 weeks. Jay Vine was supposed to ride the Giro d'Italia in support of Tadej Pogacar. Back to Corrections Corner, and I've got one as well from last week. I said three non-Spanish riders had ridden in the first incarnation of the Euskaltel, Euskadi team, and it was wrong. There were four. The fourth was a Frenchman called Pierre Cazot, also from the French Basque Country, who rode for them in 2011-2012, thanks to Fran Reyes, who messaged me about that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, and all of our listeners can get a really great discount off a NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. That link will also give you 4 months extra on top of a 2-year plan. And there's no risk because Nord offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. The link will be in the podcast episode description box as well. It's nordvpn.com/TCP. Now, why should you sign up for a virtual private network like NordVPN? Well, basically because it protects your private data when you're online. So when you're using your bank account or entering passwords, it's keeping all of that information safe. You're protected with NordVPN very easily. One simple click and the VPN is activated. You can use it on up to 6 devices, so you can protect your laptop, your phone, tablet, even your smart TV if you have one. And you can also protect your data while you're away traveling using public Wi-Fi. That's one of the key benefits for me, but there are lots of other benefits as well. NordVPN also protects you from viruses or malicious malware or phishing websites. They are the ones that look like bona fide websites but actually are there to snag your data. So NordVPN has got you covered for all of those things. And there are some other benefits too, such as switching your virtual location so that you can carry on watching your favourite streaming shows or sporting events that might be geo-restricted when you're away on holiday. So if you want to sign up for NordVPN, it's about the price of a cup of coffee a month, and it's at nordvpn.com/TCP. Now, before I hand back to Daniel, just a mention for the 1101 Cappuccino email, talking of coffee. Richard Abraham makes his debut this week with a really nice piece about his trip to the Roubaix Velodrome at the weekend. I hope you enjoy reading that. If you're subscribed to the 1101 Cappuccino, it will be in your inbox already. It's also on the Substack app. Just search for the Cycling Podcast on Substack. If you want to sign up, it's free. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, scroll down a little bit, and where you see the 1101 Cappuccino, just enter your email address, and rest assured you won't get sent any other spam, just the 1101 Cappuccino, which is written by one of us. My Whimsical Guide to the Classics series will return next week with a look at Flesh Wallon and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I hope you've been enjoying that series. One more big one to go before we start the countdown to the Giro d'Italia. Speaking of the Ardennes Classics, there's a few Friends of the Podcast episodes on the subscriber feed, which might whet your appetite for the races next week. Last year, we had a two-part mini-series with Dan Martin dissecting the character of the two races. And if you scroll back a little bit further, you'll find Lionel of the Ardennes, which is kind of a companion piece to the Lionel of Flanders, just on the other side of Belgium in Wallonia. Simon Gill and I took our bikes and went to see the 2019 editions of Flesh Wallon and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I suppose we could have called it a pair of Walloons, but well, you'll have to be the judge of that. We had a great time over there anyway, so if you want to listen to that, it's on the Friends of the Podcast feed now. Now back to Daniel and the rest of this week's episode.
Well, fellas, lots of speculation about how much all of that, those regrettable events at the Tour of the Basque Country, will affect the Tour of France. We'll get to that later. But what we can say for certain is that it was a rotten week for Visma Lisa Bike. This also because that team confirmed last week that reports in the Dutch press about DS performance chief Marijn Zeeman taking a job with football club AZ Alkmaar at the end of the season were indeed true. Now, way back in the fairly dim and distant past, Mitch, when you rode for Skill Shimano, a Dutch team, your path crossed that of Marijn Zeeman. Is that correct?
It did, actually. And we had a pretty good relationship, actually. He was just starting out in cycling. He'd worked for, I guess, a continental team beforehand for 1 or 2 years. And then he came into Skill Shimano, which was Pro Conti, but they had bigger visions, which we've seen now with, you know, where it is today, DSM. And he came in as a very highly qualified sports scientist. He had a bit of a psychology background and just a bit of a managerial sort of feel about him as well. I don't know if he had any qualifications in that area at that point, but he definitely had a big aspirations to improve that team. Specifically myself, we did quite a lot of stuff together and even worked on some psychological stuff, which was, you know, quite new, I guess, in that time. You know, we're talking back in 2009, 2010. Really went out of his way to really sort of work with me and help. I was trying to get over some psychological things about trying to do well in races and build my confidence and things like that. So he was really great with that. And we always stayed in touch. I was trying to get myself onto Jumbo at some point. Unfortunately, couldn't help me out there. But, you know, our relationship wasn't that strong, but I always had the utmost respect for him, and I liked seeing from the outside what he was building there. I don't know exactly how much he was doing there, but I got the feeling he was doing a lot at Jumbo to build it up, you know? So interesting to see where he'll go from here.
I spoke to some Dutch colleagues last week, and I believe they were taken by surprise to, well, at least to a certain extent, by this news. I think it was a case of it being reported widely, and then the team trying to, well, get back on the front foot, and then they put a press release out sort of within hours, but I believe that they were taken a little bit by surprise. Big headache for them then, and also for Bora Hansgrohe with Roglic's crash in the Basque Country, and an even more serious accident involving Leonard Kemna while he was training in Tenerife last week. Kemna was treated in intensive care for chest injuries, but as of the weekend was in a stable condition, improving, and he has been moved out of intensive care. In altogether, more trivial matters, chaps, just on Bora. There could be some good news for them in the coming months with reports that they have secured the services of Kiwi classic sensation Laurence Pithy, who, of course, at the moment rides for Groupama FDJ. Also, since we're talking about very premature transfer news, reports have gathered pace in France this week to the effect that another Groupama rider, Lenny Martinez, will definitely join Bahrain Victorious next year. Well, two big losses they would be for Groupama. I'm quite surprised. We had a debate about Mullets and Laurence Pithy the other week, didn't we, Mitch? Does he sport one? Does he not? He was certainly very impressive again in Paris-Roubaix. Now, chaps, I spoke to his agent, Manuel Quinciato, 3 or 4 days ago, and Manuel didn't confirm or deny that he was on his way to Bora, but the very, very strong impression I got was that he is indeed on his way there. It's quite early, isn't it? It's quite early in the... Well, we know that transfers cannot be officially announced before the 1st of August. Negotiations always start before then. But Mitch, it struck me that, well, we heard reports of this deal having been done after Milan-San Remo. That struck me as quite early, because it's a rider whose stock has risen almost week by week this spring.
It's very early considering what he did after that. You know, if they had signed a contract back then, he'd be pretty pissed off, because he probably could have tapped a few $100,000 on top of that with the ride at Wavelgem, Flanders and Roubaix. If it had just been conversations and he was sealing the deal right now, beautiful. That's the best possible scenario you could have ever hoped for. Got the conversation happening, get the results at the right time, shut it down right now. But look, personally, I used to do all my own, not personal contracts, but my contracts would happen around this time because I was a classics rider. And my contract would get signed around, you know, Dauphiné time. By the time you started doing the talking after Roubaix, you know, give it another a month or so, and you'd sign the contract off in the next month or so. So most of the classics riders are doing all their contract stuff now. San Remo seems slightly early, but yeah, it wouldn't surprise me the way things are going. He's showing, and they could read into it.
And if you look back at what he did at Paris-Nice as well, then San Remo, you know, there's the other side of the coin. Hang on a minute, guys, let's strike while the iron's hot. Yeah. He perhaps didn't know he was going to be so good in the Cobbled Classics. And then, you know, the attention starts to drift away. Just imagine if he disappeared, he hadn't had a good game, world game and all that sort of stuff. I think maybe they were taking the other option. So, well, you know, the value's already gone up enormously, immensely since the start of the season, just with that Paris-Nice and then the San Remo. Why not sign something now?
It could also be a sort of mundane, simple matter of practicality, can't it, chaps, in the sense that the classics races, they are a big sort of gathering of agents, team managers. It might surprise a lot of listeners that most team managers don't go to many races. I'm talking about the sort of team principals, the big bosses. But at races like Roubaix, Flanders, all of the movers and shakers are around, and those face-to-face conversations are often more effective in getting things moving than phone calls, messages, Zoom calls, etc., etc.
Well, on both sides, it's easier to push it out another week, another day, when you just got to reply to an email or a phone call. Face-to-face, you've got to answer the question right then and there, which can be good or bad. You know, if you need to buy that time as a manager or a rider, you're like, ah, geez. And then on the flip side, if you're a rider, you finally get to see the team manager face-to-face and go, what's going on with that contract, buddy? Especially at the case around sort of Welter time. If you run into a team manager then, you're sort of waiting on your contract. It's great to put the extra pressure on.
I mentioned Lenny Martinez may be bound for Bahrain victorious. We're going to get back to all matters Paris-Roubaix. And well, to take us there, we're going to go back in time, not to the race at the weekend, but to the pre-race recon, due to some popular demand after a little sort of vignette from Fred Wright of Bahrain Victorious's recon last Thursday that we featured in the Arrivé episode on Sunday. We're going to feature more of that recon now.
I went down to the river to pray, worrying about that good old day. Right to the canal, I think. Curva la queta. Oh, look at the windmills. Do you know what that means? We got a tailwind. So now it suddenly feels like we're in Belgium. Like it's like a sudden little shift. Without seeing a border crossing, everything suddenly is, hang on a minute. But I think we're in Belgium now. Yeah, we are. Can you go a little bit faster, please? I think I did a commesse in this town when I was under 23. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But why do I recognize it now? Belgium. Yeah. What?
Biceps.
Biceps are feeling it. They feeling it. I said to Alberto, I found that they remember. So the next year, say you do another recon, Roubaix, it's like you don't have the same feeling. Also your hands.
Mate, Alberto, this is Roubaix. There is nothing you can do. You just have to suffer. It's like this. My friend, can you please check the saddle height between both of my bikes? Because I feel like on the number, whatever number this one is. Yes, this is the one with the 35. So yeah, number one feels like it's slightly lower than number two. But maybe just very, I think it might be the saddle itself is older.
But maybe. We'll give you that impression. I'll give a look.
Thank you, mate.
That smell is so nice of the waffles. Left. Cherry lady. Looking for some help.
Well, chaps, another rendition there of Cherry Baby. So that really was. We speculated on Sunday with Richard Abraham about that, how that had been a real earworm for Fred Wright on his recon on Thursday. And that was a separate clip. That was a separate little ditty there from Fred, not the one that we played on Sunday. He's clearly a man with some musical talent, Fred. Down to the river, the Alison Krauss song as well there, Down to the River to Pray. Unfortunately, Fred got the lyrics wrong. The actual lyric is Down to the River to Pray, studying, or is it learning? In fact, I might have got this wrong. Learning about that good old way. Not as Fred's song, Down to the River to Pray, worrying about the good old days. Why would one worry about the good old days, Fred?
I was listening to this, to your Arrivé podcast just yesterday, and when you said earworm, I've never heard that terminology before, but I often get that, and especially when Richard mentioned Baby Shark, Simon Guerin told me, before I had kids, he told me this, or when I just first had my first kid, he goes, we made a rule in my house, no kids TV before dad goes training, because what happens is the earworm is planted and you're out there the whole day with Baby Shark or whatever. But before I had kids, or whenever I used to get an earworm, or, you know, just a song stuck in my head, most often than not, you don't know the full lyrics. You just know that one bit of chorus, and that just continually gets played around and around and around. And you're just like, I wish I knew the lyrics to this song, because this would actually be fun now. But you only know about six words.
Mitch and Fred slightly misremembering the lyrics of the Alison Krauss song. And that led to a conversation between Rob and me this morning about, well, I think this is a conversation that's been had on many radio programs over the years about songs that you go for years under the misapprehension, or, you know, thinking the lyrics are something that they're not. I gave Rob an example. You know the Steve Winwood song, Bring Me a Higher Love? Mm-hmm. I labored under the misapprehension for about 30 years that the lyric was, Break Me a Higher Loaf.
not even close.
I know. But I think everyone's got one of these.
The song is Valerie. But when it got remixed, I remember because it was like in clubs and things like that, and people were like, follow me, follow me. And I'm like, no, I don't think it is that. I remember, I'm like, hey, and you'd hear someone sing. I'm like, what did you say? You're like, no, it's Valerie. That's the name of the song. I'm like, oh, is it? That was a misconception. And then you start questioning yourself. You're like, oh, maybe it is follow me.
Love a bit of Fred Wright, though, eh? I mean, the little sort of behind-the-scenes moment, because I was working from the home studio the other day doing Roubaix commentary, and I came out for my break, and all I could hear was Fred Wright on repeat, and it's brilliant. It's life-affirming. He loves it.
Well, it made me think about just jacking in the cycling podcast completely and just giving Fred Wright a mic.
I want to be Fred Wright. Yeah,
every race, every recon, every ride that Fred Wright does from this day forth. And that should be the cycling podcast.
The funny thing I noticed about that was because you couldn't quite hear the person he was talking to, he sounded like a really annoying person. Like he was just talking to himself the whole time. And I'm like, who's he even talking to? But of course, the rider wasn't mic'd up, and the way it was sort of cut, you're like, is he just like this the whole time? Like, this would be the most annoying rider to ride next to. He's just telling all these stories randomly to nobody. But like out of context, it sounded like, this guy would be the worst person to ride next to, but of course it was chopped up to make it sound like that.
Well, chaps, from the recon, from Fred's recon to the race itself, I've given Richard Abraham's been working very hard the last 2 or 3 weeks, so I've given him the episode off today. However, he was in the Velodrome, as we know, on Sunday, and he was speaking to some of the riders as they came in, and we're going to hear from a couple of... riders now who arrived in the Velodrome pretty late, but most importantly they did finish the race, or they got to the Velodrome, which is a rite of passage for professional cyclists in Paris-Roubaix, and they'd had some memorable experiences, shall we say. So we're going to hear first from fellow Victorian, fellow exponent of the mullet, moustache as well, I think, Cyrus Monk, and Blake Quick of Jayco Alula. Here they were on Sunday.
I had one thing in my head, just keep riding, and had a lot of shit go wrong, which I assume happens to a lot of people, but I didn't make it this far by giving up when things didn't go my way, so figured I'd just keep going. Knew that I was going to be a long, long way behind by the time I rode on flat tyres for that long, but good to do some recon for next year. Honestly, mentally not that hard. I was just thinking keep riding, but disappointing to not be able to do anything in the race after the punctures, but I think that's Roubaix. I think Roubaix is the Hunger Games. I think everyone at home just wants to watch us suffer, and yeah, every sector is like the cannon going off and someone gets killed, but for me that was the first sector, and then it was 29 sectors of hell after that.
I mean, you've made it to the Velodrome. Yeah. Just tell me about your day.
I had a puncture out of the group I was in, and then was riding alone for ages, and then two guys caught me, Marco Haller and one other guy, and then they pulled off and pulled out, so I just kept going alone again. I eventually got together with a group for a while, and then because we were so far behind, we had no water or no food or nothing. But yeah, it's over now. Hopefully, I'll never have to do that again.
How far are we talking here? Like
an hour on my own, probably. Not very fun.
Everyone kind of says Roubaix is the one race that you know you'll make the effort to finish, even when common sense is telling you to pull out.
Yeah, definitely. I was alone for a long time out there, and I didn't want to be there, but I mean, it's Roubaix, so you finish.
There's another Aussie out there. I think Cyrus is still going, from what I've heard.
Cyrus is still going. I thought we had the sag wagon behind us, so
he may well be behind it.
Yeah, all right. well, props to him. If he gets through, I'll see him at the airport for a beer.
So, Mitch, what did those clips, particularly Cyrus Monk there talking about the Hunger Games, I thought that was a great analogy. What did that stir up in you?
A couple of things. He said, I just wanted to keep writing. You know, it's a good old-fashioned saying from Heyman that his quote for the classics is just keep writing, just keep peddling. And that always served him true. You know, you puncher, you get dropped, just keep writing. You never know what's going to happen. And especially when it comes to Roubaix. And I sort of reminisce on punching in Sector 1. That happened to me, I want to say, in 2015. And I did ride the whole of Roubaix out the back. I was so determined to make it inside time limit that I had probably one of the best days I'll ever have in Roubaix. I could have won Roubaix that day. I finished only 20 minutes behind the peloton. I was super proud of that because I was just fuming. The team didn't wait for me. I didn't get a spare wheel and I was just riding on anger. So I knew exactly what it's like being out the back in a race you've prepared for and you punch or you have a mishap on Sector 1. You're like, I didn't even get a chance to do anything in the race yet. It's so frustrating. That, again, what I drew out of that was, this race, it's no wonder people love this race as riders. This draw to finish it. There's no other race like this. The only thing I can think of is a Grand Tour or the Tour de France that riders go through whatever they need to get to the end, to achieve it. You know, like we've seen guys having broken bones and push on to the Champs-Élysées to say they've done it. And Roubaix's that race. I can't think of another classic like it. That people go through hell just to get to that velodrome, that draw to finish it, the challenge of getting there. And as a rider, you still just don't know if you are going to get there. And the thing that I like about Cyrus is that the first time he rides it, it was important for him to get there to set the... I was only going through some legend riders and, you know, just recently, you know, Magnus Backstead and George Hincapie and these guys. I was just checking out their old results and, you know, even Fabian Cancellara didn't finish his first Roubaix. You know, it's funny, like the legends, sometimes the race defeats you. It doesn't matter who you are. It's not that easy to get to Roubaix. And Cyrus proved that point.
Is that where the sort of old adage of having to learn the classics maybe comes from? I mean, maybe it's not as relevant now with some guys turning up and winning first, but particularly Roubaix having to, you know, sort of go through that apprenticeship maybe.
I think of the apprenticeship of understanding the toughness of the race. I think Roubaix is very different. I'm not too sure if you're alluding to this, but I would definitely, if you're in terms of the apprenticeship of learning the classics, I would say very much so with Flanders. Flanders is so much about, and I could be wrong here now, like you said, it has changed a bit, but Flanders was so much about understanding where you need to be on the road, learning those little tips, how to move up, how to use energy, even when to take a nature break, all those little tips that take a long time to learn. And in my case, where to know to when to get dropped. You know, if you get dropped in the middle of nowhere with no support cars there, you're trying to find your way back to the bus. It's a bit of a skill knowing how to get out of a race. You don't really want to get too good at that though. Roubaix is also like that. And as Cyrus said, he was riding with a couple guys and they just jumped in their car left. He jumped in his car right. And all of a sudden he's like, well, I've got no choice here but to ride to the finish. And that can sometimes be a good thing. You're forced to get there. With a race like Roubaix, there is no race next week, so you can sort of bury yourself as well. If I'm on my hands and knees at the end of this, who cares? I'm on my break. I think the apprenticeship in Roubaix is the toughness, the mental toughness you need to learn. So he's done that year one, and I'm sure a lot of other guys have done that, whether they're out of time, whether they've been 50th, 20th, wherever. They come out of it going, holy F, I didn't think it was going to be that hard. Now, in the next year, they go back and they're ready for that.
Mitch, what do you think about just throwing a guy into Paris-Roubaix? As you know, I said it was a bit of a rite of passage. There were a couple of riders on the start list on Sunday. AJ August, Andrew August, the teenager for Ineos. I mean, I meant to check this actually, ask the team what his weight, in fact, is. But I saw it quoted as sort of being in the low 60s. 50 kilos, maybe I think in some places even the high 50 kilos. And he's a rider who's been sort of earmarked as a stage race prospect. And I don't know exactly what the sort of backstory is of why he was riding Paris-Roubaix, but just for a young rider who maybe will go on to do completely different things in the sport as an experience, does it have value? You know, maybe in terms of, well, just fulfillment of a lifetime ambition for the rider personally, but also from the team's point of view in terms of giving them something, giving them a kind of well, a legacy of sort of resolve or determination that they then can carry forward into their career.
I think it's really easy to argue both ways, and I can see both ways on this, and that's a really annoying answer to your question. But initially I was thinking, why would you do that? Why would you take so much risk with a young guy? It's such a dangerous race. He's not really going to get much out of it. Probably won't come back there. Is it training for, you know, potentially the Tour de France in years to come? They go on the cobbles. It's just a different beast, I can imagine, racing a stage race on the cobbles, apparently different to Roubaix. Different time of year, different riders, racing a different way. So would you learn that much there? Would you get enough in a recon, or do you need the stressfulness of Roubaix? That's probably that argument there for the teams. As a rider later on in his career, I think it's an awesome thing to have on his checkbox that he probably will like later on his career, and he may never go back there. I don't know exactly if he will or not. Maybe he'll turn into a classic specialist, who knows? But maybe like a guy like Simon Gerrans, again, to refer to him, did it once in his career and he's like, great, I'm glad I did that with AG2R in my first year. They threw me in it. I'm really happy now because I got to do it, because I would have never have done that late in my career once I knew how stupid that would be for me as a rider. It just didn't fit. I'm going to do Basque Country, blah, blah, blah. So he checked it off as a young guy when it didn't have that much effect on the rest of his season. Once he got older and people expected results from him, and he probably wanted to check Roubaix off, he wasn't going to go there. You know, as an older rider, imagine how hard it would be to go back and do Roubaix in your last year, you know, like, say, sort of like Wigo did at the end.
Yeah, although I have heard as well on numerous occasions in the past, there have been classics riders who have been more with a kind of Ardennes sort of physiology, or, you know, someone like Michele Bartoli, for example, is a good example of a rider who did it for the first time late in his career and then regretted not having done it much more often before that. You know, I wonder about a guy like Tim Wellens. This weekend, who, you know, Tim Wellens must be in his 30s now, is he?
He's well into his 30s. He wasn't the oldest debutant at the weekend. I think that was Ben Swift, actually, in his late 30s. He made a debut. There were 59 debutants.
I saw him on Puig Mayol last
week. He was. He had a warm weather week in Mallorca between Flanders and Roubaix.
Swifty's never done Roubaix?
Until last weekend, no. Ben Swift, no. Connor Swift had done it, his cousin, but Ben Swift
Ben
hadn't,
Swift?
No.
Taylor Swift has never done it.
Well, Swifty sure would have done it already.
Yeah, that surprised me. I mean, you know what it's like. You've done quite a bit of the commentary yourself. Now you sit down, you do your notes, you look at what's happening, and you're thinking, wow, 34% of the peloton was riding for the first time at the weekend. 59 debutants. That was about 15, roughly more than last year. And I think we had three teenagers as well. It wasn't just Andrew August. So there were a lot of riders in there, a lot of guys in their 20s, young 20s. I think there were four or five, six riders who would have been the youngest ever winners had they won. So there was a real sort of different spectrum of riders. But going back to your point on Tim Wellens, he looked pretty comfortable for a while, didn't he? And he might be one of the guys thinking, hang on a minute, I wish I'd have had a different go at this.
Mitch, the race itself, off mic before we started recording, and in fact last week as well, we talked about the break, the role of the break, why it makes sense to get into a break. We saw a break of, what, seven riders initially, didn't we? Which then became nine, did it?
It did.
And it didn't last too long. I think they were caught with about 140 kilometers to go just as the peloton reached the first sectors of cobbles. There were a couple of surprising names in there: Marco Haller, Casper Asgreen. Why didn't it get further, Mitch? Why didn't it have the effect on the race that we expected?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I was messaging a few different people going, Asgreen, he's going to go far today. Great move, going to save, you know, Quick-Step's classics potentially, even with a good result. He potentially could have saved at a podium, would have been fantastic for that team. I was very surprised. But then again, you know, Albertson, they just had a stranglehold on it. They were so committed as a team, riding with the speed. The tailwind didn't help. The tailwind definitely didn't help. The teams could just get on the front and control things. And the lead-in, too, they just, it took so long. The lead-in just soaked up or took away so much of their time. You can't underestimate that lead into the first sector. And it didn't, again, watching it on TV, even for me, I was like, oh, I don't know, is it that crazy anymore? Watching that time come down, I'm like, they're moving so quick here. It is a bunch lead out for that first sector. So I think it just came down to, for me, just the control and what Albertson wanted to do for the race was, it was clear that, you know, Vanderpool had, whether he'd said this or not to his teammates, I'm going to go early. Let's keep it fast. Let's keep it hard. He said in the interview afterwards, I know that I go well when the race is really hard. You know, I wanted to make the race hard. So that was the plan from the start. They didn't want a big period of the bunch sitting up and recovering after this attacking period. Let's just keep it rolling. Let's keep this race fast and let's keep it going. The guys in the break didn't feature because they had to be on the pedals the whole time. They had to attack to get in the break. Then they had to try and ride hard again. Once the bunch caught them, they had nothing left. So, yeah, look, generally the break in Roubaix is the one of the races that it's the hardest to get into because it is so profitable. Big riders you see feature in that break. You know, Stuart O'Grady winning from the break way back in the day. Heyman winning from the break, the two Aussies. So it is possible, you know, even the likes of myself have got a result from the break. You know, a top 15 for me was such a big result, but I wouldn't have been able to do that unless I was up the road, missing all the carnage behind.
Sylvain Dillier, actually, one of the riders who was working so hard for Alpecin de Koenig back when he was Swiss champion, famously finished second, didn't he, from the morning breaker. He was caught by Sagan, who then beat them in the sprint, but he was part of that team. And you look down at every single member of that team, you talked about them taking control early on. They've sort of transitioned into Soudal Quickstep, haven't they? What they were now, strength in numbers, and it was like that certainly this week, to an extent last week with Vermeers marking all those moves from Pearson and what have you. And you looked on right until the last 50, 60Ks. They had at least three, maybe four riders up there.
What we have seen with Van der Poel is that his strength gives his team the luxury of almost imagining the finish line is 60 kilometres from where it actually is, in fact. And I know Vermeers in this instance went a lot further, and he was very much, well, he finished sixth, didn't he? But he almost, Mitch, you said it was almost as though he'd said to them, I'm going to go early, or he did say to them, I'm going to go early. But it's almost been like that every week in the classics, that they can kind of forget about the last 50 kilometers because he'll just take care of business. And that's where maybe they kind of differ a little bit from Soudal Quickstep. They always did have numbers very deep into the race.
I'm wondering also, and going back on some old racing, I mean, looking back into the old 1-2-3 from Mappes, not when they crossed the line together, but when they had one rider up the front, you know, specifically Taffy's victory, and the two riders behind, Wilfred Peters and, you know, Tom Steels, was a little bit similar to Philipson and Vermeersch, riding in that group behind and playing that protective role. And that was sort of what happened way back in 1999. They get away and they can just sort of sit on the others and watch them chase. And I guess the question I have is, Philipson, twice second, if he was a leader in his own team, is he able to ride Roubaix as well? Or is this allowing him to ride a better Roubaix, not focusing so much pressure on himself? I wonder that. And as a rider, for me, I know I would perform better doing a job than riding for myself. But I was a domestique style rider and I liked that. It took the pressure off me and suddenly I was able to sort of ride better. Him being a winner himself, what would happen if he was trying to win Roubaix, I wonder?
Maybe he should think about this when he's thinking about this contract that's much publicised now, you know, talking about he wants a four-year deal. But the grass isn't always greener, is it? And you look at riders, for example, if we're using the Quickstep example again, riders who leave there where they've got their strength in numbers and they've not really managed to sort of transfer their own classics ability into a team where they're the sole leader.
Yeah, and everyone, when thinking about the various sort of permutations and options available to him, we're all thinking about lead-out trains and how it's going to impact his sprinting. But, you know, he's a rider for whom, well, this period of the year is very much dedicated to the classics. And he, you know, he's one of the best classics riders in the world. So that should really come into his thinking. Mitch, a lot of the talk last week was about Arenberg Forest and this chicane, which was which turned into one of the biggest sort of nothing burgers I think we've seen in Paris-Roubaix, in the sense, and you know, this was good news as far as we were all concerned, really, particularly given what we'd seen in the Tour of the Basque Country. There were no crashes on the chicane. You obviously have got personal experience with, well, crashing in the Arenberg Forest, and crashing, well, badly, seriously. It was a crash that could have cost you your career or even more, Mitch. So it came too late last week. It was after we recorded this talk of the chicane. What did you make of it all, and what did you make of what we saw in the end?
Yeah, I noticed there was quite a gruesome image of me floating around. Jorgensen decided to post that image.
Oh, that was you. That was you. Of course it was. Yeah.
I know. Couldn't see it behind all the tomato sauce smeared on my face after eating a big pie. It was... Look, I don't know. I obviously have got, I guess, if anyone's got credibility to say something, you know, after crashing on Arenberg, I probably do. I sort of like just leaving it as it is, because it just... It's part of the race. It's... We all know the risks, and that's just what it is. It's a massive element of the race. And most often, I'm not going to say always, Wallers, the sector before, is where the crashes happen. There's always a crash on Wallers. And that's how I had my crash. I was trying to cross the gap on Arenberg. I was caught behind in Wallers, and I thought I can get across the front group on Arenberg. Maybe I went in there a little bit too keen and, you know, slipped out. Who knows? I don't know exactly what happened. But
it's just reminding us of the dynamic of the crash. It was you slipped out. You didn't hit another rider. It wasn't equipment failure.
No, exactly what I just said then. Yeah, the bunch was split on Wallers, and there was probably 40 riders in front, and, you know, I was just caught behind a crash, so there was a split, and the gap was probably 10, 15 seconds at the most, so they could just there. So you could go, cool, let's just hop across, and I'll just be at the back of the first group when I come off Arenberg. And that was it. We came in, straight run in, nothing too dangerous, and I just, front wheel just slipped out. It was wet from the night's rain or the days before rain, so the stones were dry, but in between it was wet. So far as I know, the front wheel just slipped away and I never got my hands down. Had nothing to do with the way the riders were riding, anything like that. It just had to do with the stones. So... I don't know, going around a chicane, the only difference would have been I would have crashed at a slower speed, but I think the crash would have still happened. So the chicane for me, I think there's better ways of doing it. You know, there is a side street that runs into the lead up they could use. They could also enter the Arenberg from the opposite way, which they've done in years before. That means it's your right-hand turn into Arenberg and they loop back around, which was the way they did it after Musée's crash. So I think putting this chicane here, for me, really ruins the one of the beautiful parts of the race, Roubaix.
I think we'll talk a lot more about safety in other contexts as well in the next part. Chaps, we are going to talk about safety. Everyone's been talking about safety in the last week. In the news roundup, we talked about that terrible crash in stage 4 of the Tour of the Basque Country and the consequences of that crash. I don't know how far we want to get into the speculation. I don't know, Mitch, whether you've got any sort of points of reference which can instruct us on, you know, likely recovery times. We probably don't know. Well, first of all, we're not doctors. And secondly, we probably don't know enough specifically about the injuries to be able to hazard very, very educated guesses about when people are coming back. There have been various predictions about sort of 10-week recoveries, 8-week recoveries for Evenepoel and Vingegaard. There have been some interviews, quotes with Visma Lisebike management, Richard Plugger, I think Marijn Zeeman himself also spoke to the press, in which they were pretty circumspect, as you would imagine in these cases, either saying we can't really make any plans yet, or giving the impression that they might have to, the sort of vague impression that they might have to reevaluate, and it's not looking too good for Jonas Vingegaard. Mitch, have you got anything to say on this, on whether you think it is likely we'll see Jonas Vingegaard the Tour de France, what kind of shape he's going to be in? Same for Evenepoel.
Look, I think Vingegaard, like, of course, not knowing the injuries, so it's very hard. So I'm only speculating once again, just to sort of cover my ass here. But, you know, even if he does go to the tour, it's almost like, what's the point now? So precise his preparation in the lead up in the last few years, and to compete against Pogacar, let alone the others there. It seems like coming back from this, it's not just a broken collarbone or, you know, something, put that lightly, but, you know, broken collarbones, you know, got over so quickly these days. So I think the way they go about it, they would, you know, refocus and make sure when he comes back, he is ready and he has time to not rush things and come back and damage his sort of, his legacy almost, you know, to come back too early and be sort of half there and put on a half performance and be sort of disappointed with himself, go away and you know, take on the Vuelta and then come back with a vengeance the following year. But it's so hard to think like that now. It is still so early. To bring it back just quickly on myself, like that crash we spoke about at Roubaix, I was back racing at Dauphiné and I never would have thought that. So that's only sort of, you know, 6 weeks after Roubaix. So it definitely is possible.
What specifically were the injuries? There was a face injury. And what were your other injuries, Mitch?
Well, I broke all my front teeth out, so I had to get all them repaired and sort of false teeth put in, pretty much. And make myself look pretty again, so, you know, stitch my face back up. So, look, it was only facial injuries, but that was pretty quick, in my opinion, to be racing such a brutal race like Dauphiné. I just don't think they would take that risk unless you can come back properly.
Well, knowing the way they operate, this Melissa bike, everything's methodical, isn't it? Everything's sort of thought about to the nth degree. But they've got two of those big decisions to make, haven't they? Because one's coming quicker, Wout van Aert. And obviously when he races, everything's behind him. He's got the whole team support behind him. It's all about, he says, stage wins at the Giro. But they've got to now decide what happens with him. Does he ride the Tour de France instead? Does Jonas Vingegaard then go to the Vuelta? Do they change what they were going to do at the Vuelta with, you know, maybe people who had leadership there push to the Tour? Does Matteo Jorgensen now go to the Ardennes, or does he maybe think about the general classification at the Tour de France? There's loads of things to think about, but it isn't just a decision for them that involves the Tour de France. There's sort of more pressure on because they've got to juggle everything around again before the Giro.
We obviously have seen various examples in the last few years of riders getting injured in spring and then getting ready with a sort of accelerated preparation or recovery. Mitch, you mentioned yourself, Pogacar, of course, last year broke his wrist, didn't he, at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and was a bit undercooked, I think, is the general consensus, and his feeling at the Tour de France. Going back a bit further, remember that the controversial Lance Armstrong in 2009, remember he broke his collarbone at the Vuelta a Castilla y León, which I think at that time, does it still happen at the end of March?
And he came back and rode the Giro, didn't he, to warm up?
He did, yeah, that's true. So, and other examples, Roberto Vicentini in the 1986 Giro d'Italia, he rode and won that with a broken, he started the race with his wrist in plaster. So, who knows what might be possible. But the crash itself, chaps, has caused some degree of, well, hand-wringing and, well, worthwhile and necessary conversation about safety in the sport. And a bit of a sort of, well, a bit of soul-searching, I would say, in the days that followed the crash, because of the reputations and of the riders involved, obviously very important riders, Evenepoel, Roglic and Vingegaard. We'd been very excited about the Tour of the Basque Country. This was going to be a rare occasion before the Tour de France where we're going to see three of them together, two of them now with big question marks over their participation in the Tour de France. Mitch, I propose, I was thinking about how to tackle this, and there was a whole sort of gamut of suggestions of what needed to be done, what can be done in professional cycling to make it safer, that were volunteered in the hours and days after this crash. And I thought I'd hit you with a few of them. You can react, Rob Hatch, you can react as well, and tell me what you think. So, Romain Bardet, current rider, of course, he pointed to the fact that, particularly in the last couple of years, the signage, if that's a word, and generally the way the courses are laid out, or the Tour de France is of a superior level to other races. Is that a solution?
The signage in the ASO races?
In the Tour de France, yeah, and particularly last year we had these acoustic, what they called acoustic warnings, didn't we, as well? And basically someone sort of shouting over a tannoy.
I think the ASO signage is superior, and clearly it does help. I think it is something to look into. I remember when it first came in that they were talking about, and these guys were telling me they were putting it up. I was in Paris-Nice. And they had the company there, and they were doing the big arrows, like, you know, that we see all the time now. It was the first time we'd see them. I'm like, this is so stupid. Like, why do we need this? But actually, it did help. Rather than just like a little placard left-hand turn on some sign.
I think we have to give Flanders Classics quite a bit of kudos on that as well, because they've got the electric boards. It's like you're on a motorway, isn't it? They'll point around the corner. They were, I think, one of the first organisers as well to install those brand new barriers at the finish, with the sort of side leaning ones, the plastic ones without the feet and things like that. So they do a pretty good job on it. But obviously ASO as the ones that everybody are looking at have to sort of set the example, don't they?
And Mitch, the speed of races, and this was pertinent at the weekend because we had the fastest ever edition of Paris-Roubaix. We've had the fastest ever, Rob, what was it? The fastest ever San Remo,
I've got the list,
Flanders,
actually. So
E3.
We've seen the fastest ever Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, Kurne Brussel Kurne, San Remo, Ronde van Vlaanderen, and Paris Roubaix.
Why? Well, better training, better bike.
Tailwinds.
Tailwinds as well. But the speed in professional cycling generally is increasing year on year. Mitch, Valentin Madouas, and he wasn't the only rider who spoke on this last week, he talked about the size of gears and the advent this phenomenon of riders using 54 teeth chain rings.
62 almost if standard. You're Josh Charlie,
yeah,
apparently.
In some cases, 56, 62. Do gears need to be restricted as they are, for example, in junior races to bring the speed down, particularly on the flat?
No, they don't. That's ridiculous. Like, I don't think that's so silly. Like, I don't think it needs to be made into a junior race. I do know that they are using 56s now. I know most of the peloton were using 56s, or most. A lot of guys were using them in Gent Wevelgem. That blew my mind. Luke Durbridge told me that. And most of the peloton ride 54s now. So, yeah, there's been a massive increase. Maybe it comes down to the aerodynamics rather than the gears. I don't know. The gears. Can we reduce gears? What are we going to do? Like rollouts, like junior rollout, where you get to the end of the race and you got to roll your wheel backwards on those tracks?
People have an issue with this. They don't like the idea that at the highest level of a sport, the level of performance, or what's available to facilitate the best possible level of performance, is restricted. In golf, in professional golf, for example, recently, and this took years and years, people have been clamoring for it for years, there have been restrictions. Well, now we're going to have a different ball for the professionals, in effect, and amateurs are going to be able to play with a ball that goes further than the professionals. But that's almost a practical question, because the courses are becoming too short for the longest players in the world, the best players in the world. But philosophically, people have an issue with this, don't they? And it's a bit like the weight limit with bikes. People don't like the idea that the professionals can't be on the lightest available bike.
And the weight limit, I can get on board with more. I certainly can, because I think that is something that, you know, if the bike's
good, safety thing itself.
It is. But I would say that's a complete building block of safety. That's one of the principal elements, because if the bike's collapsing under, if there's a danger of that's going to happen, then that is an issue. But again, I think the philosophical question of wanting to, or people maybe not directly wanting to stop progress, but as a product of it, progress being stopped, I find that really difficult to get on board with as well.
Disc brakes, they have made braking better, more effective, but kind of later. That's what the pros say, that you can brake later these days, and this causes issues.
So it's more dangerous now. Is this the argument?
Yeah, that is an argument that's also being made, as well as the argument with Bardet also pointed out of, which was an argument we heard a lot when they were introduced, that they that the rotors can become kind of dangerous weapons. But Mitch, yes, the fact that riders might feel safer on their bikes now, does that paradoxically make things more dangerous because they take more risks?
I'd be happy on that note to see us all go back on 90s vintage bikes. How cool would that be? Rim brakes, proper, you know, box rims. It seems like we're going to go back and do it retro bikes. Yeah, I don't know. Like, no, it's the same thing. Like, everyone's going to just keep pushing it to the limits, whether it's rim brakes, whether it's disc brakes. It's just going to find a new limit. It's still going to be just as dangerous. It's like Arenberg. It's just making the bottleneck at a different point. Like, let's just keep changing. You know, it's the same thing. We're going to just keep pushing the limits. By moving the bottleneck at Arenberg, it means there's going to be, you know, crashes just before Arenberg on that corner instead of on Arenberg. And by changing the brakes, you know, there's... That's my theory anyway. Like, there's still going to be crashes on wet corners because the rim brakes didn't work as well. You know, we weren't riding any safer.
But Mitch, when one senses danger and has a more sort of vicarious,
like, take it easier.
Yeah, I mean, this is an observation and certainly not a recommendation. But you were talking about the 1999 edition of Paris-Roubaix. If you go back and watch bunch sprints from the 90s when riders were not wearing helmets, a lot of them were not wearing helmets. The one thing you notice from the overhead helicopter shots immediately is that the riders are leaving a big space between, you know, between each other, and they are, you know, they are sort of, the way they ride is dictated by that kind of instinctive sense of fear and insecurity that they have, and there is a suspicion that some of that has gone away, that riders feel actually very safe, and consequently their behavior isn't as prudent as it should be.
I like what I'm hearing. Once again, it means we're going back to a really stylish sort of part of cycling. You know, we bring back the casquettes and the headbands and the rim brakes and actually good-looking bikes. I like this argument. You know, it's looking like we're going to be back in the good era of good-looking riders.
You'll love the next one. Marc Madiot. You can always rely on Marc Madiot to lobby for a return to the good old days. He gave an interview to West France, and he talked about the amount of information that's now available on Garmin head units, computers, etc. And he pointed out that a lot of riders, they're unfortunately a little bit like drivers in cars looking at their mobile phone a lot of the time, or just looking at their GPS systems, and they can become sort of mesmerized by the amount of information that's available to them, and this distracts them, and this can also cause crashes. What do you think about that?
The argument there is that supposedly they were to reduce crashes, you know, because we had the information and you could see the turns, and so we're going back to the cat eyes on the bars, the old speedos. I do agree with a lot of these points, but you can argue both sides because it has made the cycling, the radios, you know, you take the radios out, you know, apparently that was take no radios, but then they go, well, that's safer with radios because they're telling us about dangers and stuff coming up. And I would agree with that, but then on the other side, you're like, they still did it without radios, didn't they?
A lot of these suggestions seem to be product of the era of the person that's talking. It's a generational thing. Unfortunately, like a lot of polarizing topics in society are right now. I struggle to get on board again with sort of putting the brakes on progress. But again, you know, we could go back and have another philosophical debate as to what is progress. If we're talking pure performance, then yes. But something needs to be done. We need to have a conscience. We need to be... I was talking to Matt Stevens on my Gruppetto show the other day, and he was saying it's good to see people being proactive, trying to do something before. I think you and I, Daniel, aren't necessarily the people to have the right opinions on a lot of these because we aren't the ones putting our bodies on the lines going in there. We can bring up the topics, and Mitch is certainly much more qualified than you and I.
You're definitely not a bike rider. I saw that last week.
Of course. Well, I think we knew that anyway. But, you know, it's good to have them presented to us. You and I, Daniel, can maybe make a whimsical comment, say, oh, I don't like that, it's a bit whatever. But, you know, if people like Mitch, who have ridden their bikes and been in there and suffered the consequences of a lot of these actions, you know, isn't in agreement with all of them, it just shows what a difficult job it is to bring the right suggestions in, doesn't it?
Yeah, there were a couple of other things I was going to mention. Smaller pelotons, that's sometimes suggested as a route to a safer sport. The race radio thing, Mitch, well, we've all touched on it there, but there has been this suggestion in the past that there should be a single, well, it should be, the riders should be connected not to their team cars, but to race radio, which would only dispense safety information. You know, you've got a roundabout coming.
You wouldn't carry a radio. If that was the case, no riders would carry a radio. Like, would it be mandatory to carry one then, wouldn't it? Because riders would just be like, wait, why am I going to carry an extra radio?
That brings us back to one of the other points that's genuinely made as well by a lot of riders as well as people watching on, is that it's not all external factors. Riders have to take some sort of responsibility for their safety as well.
That was where I was going to get to. Last week, Mitch, I was exchanging messages with Joe Dombrowski, who of course was retired at the end of last year. In his view, it was generally, in his experience, it was riders being reckless that caused crashes. And in fact, you know, the UCI president, David Lapartion, in the last few days has said that based on the UCI's research, what they've observed, and they've been keeping a sort of database of all crashes in the last couple of years, that 50% are due to recklessness or rider behavior, rider error.
I totally think it comes back to that. It comes back to more inexperienced riders coming into the peloton through different forms of turning professional these days. Riders getting picked up from Zwift, from Strava, people being able to access their power files much easier. Whereas before, you had to get found, you know, even before my time, you had to get sought out through racing, through racecraft, by winning races. You couldn't get found out by someone doing a great training ride and going, did you hear about so-and-so? He just set the record up, you know, this back climb. Let's hire him as a pro. Now we can see the access of the files, which is a great thing, and we can find these diamonds in the rough, but they're learning to race at the top end. They're not doing years and years of racing. I know a couple of Australians who have gone through that route. Jimmy Whelan being one, you know, started riding a couple of years later, he was racing in the World Tour, learning how to race in the World Tour. Once you get half the peloton like that, inexperienced riders, that creates such a different dynamic. They've got the engine, but they don't know how to use it yet. So you put all them in there, plus the radios, what is getting pushed into the ear now by directors is so different to what I had at the start of my career. It's so much pressure to be in the position to move forward, to be in this position. No respect for the guys. Don't worry about them. Just cut them off. Just do this, do that. And it's just like these inexperienced, and they're just pushing forward and doing that. And that is, for my opinion, contributing to what the crashes is now.
And it really is progress, and we shouldn't, the factor that I'm about to name, it really is progress, and it's a fantastic development. And the guy who developed it is a friend of the cycling podcast, but Ben Lowe of VeloViewer, for example, I've talked to Ben about this, but that is something that has been cited as having caused issues. I think rather than the platform itself, VeloViewer itself, it's the fact that now riders have a lot of information about the course. We've all seen, I've stood outside team buses nowadays, stand outside team buses waiting for riders for 45 minutes rather than 5 minutes back in the day, because that's how long briefings last, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, an hour in some cases, because every kind of road, every corner is being micro analyzed, and of course this is going to cause stress. It's a fascinating subject. Unfortunately, it's a sensitive subject as well, and it's a fraught subject because we are talking about the well-being of riders. But it's a fascinating one as well, because, you know, I ask myself, are there other factors, like the way we are generally as people in the world nowadays, is our sort of ability to react to danger, clear and present danger, is that diminished by being on our phones and being on screens all the time? Is that a factor? I mean, these are questions that we'll probably never find satisfactory answers. The UCI and, well, various stakeholders in professional cycling are trying to find answers. They announced an initiative in Bilbao at the start of the Tour de France last year, Safer Cycling. It's a sort of working group, isn't it, Rob? A kind of consultation between various sort of associations and riders associations, the UCI itself. It's being funded as well by partly by the riders. They announced in Bilbao last year that they're not going to be, well, that group and its recommendations, they're not going to sort of be brought forward fully until 2025. This has caused some frustration. I know Richard Plugger, the Visma Lisa bike manager, has expressed his frustration at how slowly it's all moving. But I get the sense that, as I said, there has been this soul searching after last week and something will happen. But obviously, it's not going to completely solve the problem.
The sad thing is, I think that it's taken the biggest names to crash for this to happen, you know, and no life is worth more than another, no injuries, you know, of a worse nature than another if it's the same injury regarding different people and different riders is what I'm getting at there. It's disappointing it's taken that, but I know, as you say, there were conversations happening. I was lucky enough to be at the UCI in February, I think it was, with a group of another around 15 to 20 commentators from broadcasters from all over Europe. And we were given talks about how this was going to be implemented. And again, there's a lot of goodwill there. We just seem to be lacking the sort of... I think we seem to be lacking sometimes a bit of leadership, and the UCI realising that they are the ones who should be making the law, setting the law, you know, not quite being autocratic, but being a little bit more firm in how they hand things down. I got the sense that a lot was, well, you know, it's the sort of fault of everybody and we're all trying to do this together. And you just want someone to take the topic by the scruff of the neck and act.
Chaps, we've got a few more minutes, before I'm going to release Mitch back into the wild. Amstel Gold at the weekend. Race I think we've talked about before, Mitch, and I was quite surprised by what affection you had for Amstel Gold, but it is the sort of the classic switch gear, switch geography. Now we kind of move south, really south in Northern Europe.
We go east.
It feels like we go south. We're moving more towards the kind
of... It gets warm. We're moving towards summer.
Yeah, the hillier, warmer, nicer stuff, if you ask me. Brabant's Appeal tomorrow, Rob?
Yes, you're going to take me to the airport in about 40 minutes to that. It's one of my favourite races of the year, is Brabant's Appeal. Sort of a halfway house between the cobbles and the hills. We're moving east, and then I'm off to Maastricht at the weekend, as well as its famous treaty, famous for its race, Amstel Gold.
Mitch, I am right, aren't I? You quite like Amstel Gold.
I've only done it once.
Oh, okay.
I like the area because I lived right there. Yeah, I lived on the course, practically. But I didn't like the crossover of the two riders, the cobblestone riders and the Ardennes riders. It's a bad mix. And then afterwards it becomes the Ardennes riders. But that one race, you get that little bit of crossover. And then coming out of cobblestones and you get these fresh Ardennes riders. And it's just like...
The in-laws arriving at a family gathering.
Yeah. It's a weird mix, and you, as a guy who's just hanging on for grim death, you don't like it because those guys just ride away from you, and you're like, ah, yeah. So it's those poor guys that have to hang on for one more after Roubaix. It's pretty hard.
Vanderpool is riding, Rob.
Yes, he's supposedly going all the way to Liège if he can, but he's still trying to drop a little caveat in there, you know, to see how we feel week by week thing. But let's not forget, he's only raced 5 days so far. He needs to race himself into form. He's had a few training races now, and, you know, the big ones are on the way.
There has been this question, chaps, about him and Liège. We touched on it on Sunday. Mitch, I know that we were talking off mic about the possibility of him becoming the record holder in Paris-Roubaix, winning five cobbles, five Paris-Roubaix, which would make him the record holder. He's now got two. He's 29 years of age. He's got plenty of time. Liège, I was just looking, chaps... I mentioned weight and Liège. I also mentioned weight and Roubaix at the weekend. I have this sort of preconception that no one under about 65, well, probably more than that, 68 kilos can win Roubaix. And similarly, Liège. I was looking at the riders who have won Liège. Vanderpool currently weighs 75, I think currently. Reportedly weighs 75 kilograms. I think you have to go back to definitely the early 90s, possibly the late 70s to find a heavier rider than that who has won Liège-Bastogne-Liège with its 4,000 meters plus of climbing.
It's going to be a different Liège though, isn't it, this year, Mitch, because there's no Remco Evenepoel. Will Primož Roglič make it? If he does, will, how banged up and battered will he be? Is Pogacar coming down from his altitude camp to take part?
Yes.
Well, that might just change the debate another notch or two then. But it's certainly not going to be the same as the last couple of years with, you know, Evenepoel. We're sort of waiting for that moment to when he takes off on his 20 or 30K time trial to the finish or whatever it is.
As much as I was bitching and moaning about this time in the peloton before we were talking about the crashes, as a pure viewer, as a fan of the sport, it's so fun watching the races now. These guys are just doing ridiculous stuff. And this combination of Roubaix and Liège, like you just said then, we couldn't really ever talk about this before now, but it's probably going to happen. I could see it the other way. I could see Pogacar doing it as well.
Well, chaps, we've got that to come. The Ardennes and the sort of Limburg Classic. The Limburg Classic. Is that right? Of Brabant's Appeal?
No. It's in the Brabant. It's in the Brabant. The Brabant's Appeal. It's the Flemish Brabant. And it goes into the Wallon Brabant as well. Sort of because it's the flesh, as they call it, because it's Flesh Brabanson as well in French.
Yeah.
It crosses between the Flemish and the Wallon Brabant. But Limburg is Amstel, yes.
To use a phrase employed by Fred Wright in the bit we had from his recon on Sunday, not today, in the middle of nowhere, I think.
That's harsh.
It's a nice part of the world, actually.
Yeah, they grow grapes there in Auvergne at the finish.
It's a nice part of the world, it is. Apologies to anyone from Brabanson. Chaps, that is about all. It's a busy period, very busy period for the cycling podcast. No Arrivé episode at the weekend, but it's an intense period. Friends of the podcast, we've got a few specials coming out in the next few days. I promised last week we'd have something with Ineos Grenadiers new CEO John Allott. I didn't get around to releasing that last week, but it will be released in the next few days. After that, next week we've got two friends of the podcast Kilometer Zeros. One is going to be called How to Become a Pro Cyclist. The other one is going to be called How to Become an Ex-Pro Cyclist. I won't say any more for now, but more will be revealed. And
one final question.
Go on.
Do I need to get some more keys cut for next week, or are you going to be squatting again?
Mitch, thank you very much, mate, for your loyal service throughout the Cobble Classics, not just this week.
Oh, it's always been a pleasure. I love this time of year, and even more so as a viewer. It's been great.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
And just finally, cherry, cherry lady.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.